supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family. I'm Mike and Scott. Dr. Dan Gottlieb and I recently had a conversation before a live audience of about 150 people here at WHYY, and we talked about the show's 30th anniversary. That's what we're celebrating this week, and we're going to listen to excerpts from that chat today on the show. Before we started to talk about the last three decades, about Dan's favorite moments from the show and how much the field of mental health has changed since then, before we got to all of that, Dan made a very big announcement about his future. Let's take a listen.
As of Thanksgiving, I'm not going to be doing a weekly show anymore. I'm going to be doing 6 specials a year. It was the hardest decision of my entire life, almost as hard as when I decided whether or not to sell my children on eBay. I decided no, by the way. Good.
Why was it so hard? What was your head saying? What was your heart saying? That is such a Dr. Dan question, right?
The loss for me is so primitive. When I started doing this show, it was 1985. My accident happened the tail end of 79-80. I was in the depths of my depression. I was so insecure and frightened. When I was out in the community, after I started doing it for a year or so, and somebody came up to me and said, "I listen to your show, I love it." What it meant to me is I was so scared and so alone in the community. And when somebody came up to me and said that to me, I felt safe. I told myself, there's somebody I can go to if I need help, if I need a drink, if something happens. I feel safe. So as a result of this show, I have felt held by this community. That's something that doesn't happen with radio hosts, you know? I just felt held, and I think that's a large part of why this decision was so difficult for me. And I also, I've such got great love for the people I work with, for my audience, you know, and I don't mean love with a small L, you know, I mean great love. So just one of the many reasons it was so hard.
But then why do it? What was the argument that was going on inside?
Why do it? It's 30 years. I am 69 years old. This show is really the linchpin of my whole career. And I felt that if I didn't do it now, on this anniversary, I was going to be busy for the rest of my life. And I don't want to be busy. Yeah. Who does?
But then, so many of us go through these decisions where we have to let go of something. Maybe we're not sure, is it the right time now? What helped you make the decision when your heart was telling you, but I love this?
Well, like I said, a lot of tears. A lot of tears. I began thinking about what I might want to do after this show, populations I wanted to work with that I couldn't afford to work with now. I started thinking about the possibility that I could read the New York Times in the morning. But then something happened a few months ago. So I had a friend visiting me from California, and I had to do an interview with someone, and she watched the interview. So we're walking out the back door of the building after the interview, and it's right when I was torn about this decision. And she goes on and on about what a great interview it was and what skills I have and how I'm able to bring and on and on and on. And it feels good and it feels awful at the same time. So we get to the back door, and the door opens, and there's some young employees coming in who I didn't know. And one of them says to me, "You're Dr. Dan, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." She says, "Oh," she says, "my grandmother loves you."
So that made you quit?
And even thinking the possibility, I could have dated her grandmother in college. I don't know.
But what have you learned about the process? You're somebody who usually goes through something, then digests it, and then has something meaningful to say for the rest of us. So for those of us or any of us who are in a position where they are considering a big move, whether it's retirement or getting out of a relationship or whatever it is, what must we consider before we jump or before we say, "I'm going to do this"?
Honor your emotions. Don't be driven by them. Take a step back and figure out what of these emotions are carrying valuable information for you. So, when any of us are going to make any transition about anything, there's always anxiety. There has to be. You know, I've quoted a line from a poem. I think it was written by Rachel Naomi Remen, but the line is, fear is the friction in transitions. There's always fear. It's part of our hardwiring, but is that fear giving you valuable information, or is that fear causing you to withdraw, hide, and not move? And it's the same with all the other emotions. You know, if you are angry and want to make a transition because you're angry, is that anger carrying valuable information or not? So take a step back from all of your emotions. Let yourself feel them and then take a look. Same with your thoughts, your racing mind. I can't even begin to tell you how many emotions I've had and my racing thoughts. And it was just one time. And I was with Joan, my companion, where everything burst. And I cried like a baby, like I never remember crying in my whole life. And after that, things settled down and became more clear. You know, we did a show on tears years ago. One of the things we found is the chemical makeup of tears. There's cortisol in tears, the stress hormone in tears. So at a neurochemical level, tears release, you know, and after the tears, perhaps the light comes out, things are more clear.
What were you afraid of? What were your fears?
Losing my safety net. Fear of, I'm embarrassed to say this, fear of being invisible. And theoretically, you know, invisibility means egolessness. And so theoretically, that happens when you're enlightened. So Maybe tomorrow.
But I think for a lot of people who are considering retirement, there is that question of who am I? What's my identity? What's next for me? Who am I if I'm not this person who people know in this job?
Who am I when I'm first married? I'm a husband. I'm a father. I'm a psychologist. I'm a radio host. And you know what? All of those labels are just labels. None of them describe who I am. All of our labels, none of them describe who we are. Look in the mirror. Look in your eyes, deeply in your eyes. And that's the only answer that's a true one. Who am I? I'm a good guy. I am neurotic as the day is long. All right. Friends and family, no comment. I already said it. You don't have to pile on.
Yes.
Who am I is the guy I look at in the mirror who tries to do the right thing all the time, who's insecure, who loves, who wants to be loved, who looks for well-being and sometimes finds it. That's who I am. Not a whole lot different than you or anybody listening right now.
In your experience, who does better with these kinds of big changes, and what can we learn from people like that?
People with plans, number one.
Plans like what?
For what happens after. You know, you don't want to just go off a cliff. You know, plans for what happens after. And that identity I talked about is an important part of that. Who are you beyond your labels? You know, I'm a man who is compassionate and has a talent in areas of compassion, kindness, love, helping people feel safe. That's independent of my labels. So I have faith in the literal sense. I have faith that I will be able to use those talents to help others going forward. So I also have other plans. You know, Joan and I want to travel. You know, I want to teach. I want to write. You know, I have plans, and I still want to give lectures. Plans.
Knowing you, you'll be more busy then than you are now. Just saying. We're listening to a special edition of Voices in the Family today. It's a conversation taped before a live audience here at WHYY, celebrating 30 years of Voices in the Family. Coming up, we'll discuss how much the field of mental health has changed in the last three decades, and we'll listen to some of Dan's favorite moments from the show. I'm Mike and Scott, and we'll be right back with more.
This is Dr. Ashi Wiraratna from the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. As a Wistar scientist, I'm working hard to help find a cure for melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. My research focuses on how changes in our skin as we age drives the spread of melanoma and makes these tumors resistant to drugs. To find out the importance of wearing sunscreen and more about our science, details are at wistar.org. My name is Ashi, and I am Wistar Science.
It's America's Test Kitchen Live.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball. Join me for a live performance and an insider behind-the-scenes view of America's Test Kitchen.
Wednesday, October 21st at the Merriam Theater. More at whyy.org/events.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family. We're celebrating the show's 30th anniversary. I'm Mike and Scott, and Dan and I taped this conversation that we're hearing today here at WHYY with a live audience of about 150 people in the room. Dan started hosting Voices in the Family in the 1980s, and I asked him what the field of mental health was like then. For example, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is very commonly used now, was a brand new approach then. Let's take a listen.
I came into the field right when behavior therapy was in its heyday. There was no cognitive because nobody cared about thoughts or emotions back then, if you can believe that, in behavior therapy. It was just behaviors. One of my professors in graduate school at Temple said, "I don't believe in love." He said, if you can't measure it, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. P.S. His marriage ended a few months after that. Apparently she did. But anyway, so that was behavior therapy, and it was psychoanalysis. And those were the two main domains of psychotherapy. When I got out of graduate school, it was the heyday of family therapy. So we moved from there. Even psychoanalysis was modernizing back then. You know, it was object relations theory, and they were moving towards relationships. And one of the things that started then, the relationship between the patient and the therapist is more important than the type of therapy. And that's what we're learning.
I feel like the topic of mental health has become much more mainstream, even in the years that I've worked with you. People are talking about mental health. There's news stories a lot more about mental health. Has the stigma changed, though, in your opinion?
Minimally, in my opinion. Much less than I would have hoped it to be. I mean, we did a show on college campuses. It's changed somewhat there, but even there, not as much. You know, we are afraid of the nature of our own minds. You know, the saying is, you know, our greatest fear is of ourselves, and it's true. You know, we live in fear of having a breakdown. We live in fear of being, quote, crazy. We are afraid of our own minds. We're afraid of, quote, losing our minds. And if we had enough self-compassion to be able to look in someone's eyes who's different than we are, then I think the stigma would diminish. Many years ago, we changed the name of this show from Family Matters to Voices in the Family. And it was very, very important to me to have that name, because I wanted this show to represent all of the voices in the human family, including the ones we're talking about now. One of the things I've learned from the show and from my work, it is absolutely breathtaking what people can go through and thrive. Not survive, but thrive. We've talked about a phenomenon that doesn't get talked about, and that's post-traumatic growth. You know, we talk about PTSD, but the majority of people who go through trauma grow as a result. They grow in depth as a result.
You interviewed mathematician John Nash in 2002. We were at the Free Public Library in Philadelphia. Nash had schizophrenia. He was featured in the movie A Beautiful Mind, or his life story was featured in that movie. Unfortunately, he died earlier.
Recently.
Yes. You, I remember, were so nervous going into this interview. Your hands were shaking.
Me, so, nervous?
Yes, you were so nervous. So let's hear a clip from that interview.
Could you try to tell us what it was like inside of your skin when the illness was at its worst?
It is always being described, mental illness is described as something where the people are suffering. but the people are really in an altered state of existence. Suppose you're an alcoholic. Are you just suffering because you're an alcoholic? Or maybe do you enjoy drinking?
Suffering aside, what was it like when you believed you're one of the most important people in the world? Did you feel crazed, whether it included suffering or not?
Well, it's not necessarily unpleasant to feel that you're a very important person.
Right.
He brought up some very interesting perspectives on mental illness that were jarring, almost. What was it like to be there with him?
As you graciously point out, scary. And it was scary not because it was a large audience and a national audience for that show, but I hadn't interviewed someone with schizophrenia for 20 years before that. So there's a certain kind of rhythm, a certain way of connecting with others' minds and mentalities that I hadn't done in such a long time. So I had a lot of anxiety about that. I think we were able to do it after a while, after that first question, which was kind of a nightmare for me. I asked him the first question. I forget what it was. But he went off on a tangent, picking up on one word in the question that wasn't related to the question. And he goes off on a tangent, and I'm thinking, okay, do I reel him in or cut him off? That's not going to look good. Or do I let him go? And if so, I'm out of control of the interview. So I did a little bit of both. And I think we connected, or I connected. He didn't connect, but I connected with him. I think some of his insights were remarkable. And what he said in that clip you picked out about mental illness kind of relates indirectly to what I said to you earlier about stigma and how we're afraid of our own minds. And everybody's afraid, or many people say they're afraid, of the, quote, breakdown. Well, you know, when you are out of your mind, he's right. You're not suffering that much. We neurotics, we suffer. And let me tell you a secret. When you're neurotic and you're suffering, doesn't lead to a breakdown. When you're neurotic and suffering, you just get more neurotic. I mean, your diagnosis doesn't change. It just... So, you know, he's right. He's right. There is minimal suffering. Of course, loved ones suffer. But he was an interesting, interesting man.
I also wanted to hear a clip from your interview with Jon Kabat-Zinn. He is perhaps the person most responsible for bringing mindfulness meditation in a secular way to the West, to medicine, to physical and mental health. And I think he has also created some of the connection between physical and mental health that we talk a lot about now. You spoke to Jon Kabat-Zinn here at WHYY. It was a very big event. So let's hear a clip from that.
The mind is kind of like a poorly functioning kidney. You know, the kidney kind of figures out what you need and what you don't need.
Right, and it does.
And when we start thinking, the mind goes, oh, yeah, that's important. And, oh, you know, it doesn't know what's waste matter. Which is the majority.
Well, if I didn't know how I was feeling before, now I'm feeling completely at my ease. It's wonderful to hear you talk like this. And I sometimes will, speaking of thinking, I will sometimes use the word secrete to talk about thoughts, like the mind secretes thoughts. And then these tiny little secretions that nobody really understands what they are inside our mind, and really nobody even knows where our minds are. I mean, we know where the brain is, but the mind, like, show me your mind.
What were you getting at there? This is a big theme for you, how our minds work.
Well, mostly how our minds don't work, and how we tend to overvalue what we think. And most of us live inside our thinking brains rather than in our experiential lives. My first course, mindfulness meditation, was 20 years ago. In my course was a woman with, I think, stage 3 breast cancer, not 4. And I asked her why she was taking the course. She said to me, "All my life, wherever I was always somewhere else." She said, "In the time I have left, I want to be where I am." So that when we're lost in our thoughts, we are not where we are. What I tried to get at with John is this nature of our minds and our thoughts. And when the mind is racing, you can't hear the birds outside. Literally cannot hear the birds. And I know because I meditate outside a lot.
How does it work for you in everyday life? How do you apply your practice?
As I mentioned earlier, I'm still about 24 hours away from being enlightened. When I'm aware of feeling anxious or my mind is racing, I can connect immediately to my body, to the sounds around, to my breath. And when that happens, I can feel compassion for myself, for this man who's suffering. And I spent a good part of this morning feeling that. The other thing it's done is when I sit there for a half hour in the morning, I can have these thoughts that are so important and so insightful. Or I can have these emotions. Oh my God, I got to get to this right away. I can't sit here. But I sit here. And what happens is my brain, not Dan, but my brain learns. Thoughts come and go. Emotions come and go. It's like clouds. You stare at them, they're going to change. And my brain has learned that. So it's not conscious learning. But so I am less wed to my thoughts and my emotions on good days.
Several of your former producers are here, and we would love to hear from them. And I figured we should start with Marty Moscowane, who, of course, hosts Radio Times. And she's the one who hired you. So, Marty, do you have any favorite memories of Dan or of the show?
How could I not? I'll just stand up here. Well, more than 30 years ago, I was producing a show called Family Matters, now called Voices in the Family. And I heard about this psychologist named Dan Gottlieb that everyone said was just so cool and so wise. And I called him up and we booked him on the show. And I remember going out to the parking lot out here. It was a cold January. It was icy, bitter cold evening because the show was on in the evening. I said, "That's the guy I want to host the show." I think everything that he said this afternoon can tell you why. And so as Dan deliberated about saying goodbye and essentially retiring from the show, when I went to talk to him to offer him the job, no deliberation whatsoever. He said, "Yes, I will do it." And I was a new producer. He was a brand spanking new host. We knew not what we were doing. But we figured back in 30 years ago, you could kind of make it up as you went along. And so obviously what Dan has done is really just extraordinary. And many people will come up to me when they know that I know Dan and work here at WHYY, and they say, "Oh my gosh, Dan Gottlieb, he's so kind and caring, compassionate, wise, thoughtful. He's such a wonderful man. And while that is true, Dan is also a bad boy. He really, really, really likes the ladies. And especially loves strong women, some of whom are here in this room. And I could get very weepy as I think about the 30 years that have come and gone, but I just want to thank you for taking such good care of my baby.
Jennifer Lynn, she hosts Morning Edition. And before we started hearing her beautiful voice every morning on WHYY, she produced Dan's show for a couple of years. I mean, we've long heard her beautiful voice on WHYY, but not every morning. So Jennifer, what are your favorite Dan memories?
Da-na-na-na-na, boom, boom.
He's a bad boy, ladies, men. This thoughtful human who on his business card it says human.
I put that on my business card because you can't be sued for malpractice. If...
So it's Voices in the Family, but we were certainly a family in the community of folks who were behind the scenes helping with the show. We'd have lunch together on Mondays before the show, get-togethers even, you know, outside of the building. And so early on in my production life with Dan, he invites Mike and I to go to the beach, where he has a condo in Margate. We show up at the pool, and everyone knows Dan. Everybody loves Dan. You can't go two steps without someone stopping Dan. Hi, Dan, Dan, Dan. The men and women at the pool are about 80-plus years old. So Mike and I look like really hot. I mean, I can even say so. And there's Dan with the biggest grin, talking to everybody about his lovely producers. And we were like his little entourage that afternoon. He was so pleased, so happy. Thanks, Dan, for setting us up. It's been a pleasure working with you. You're not only a human, but you're an advocate for so many people who don't have a voice. I love you so much. Thanks.
By the way, everybody in that condo calls Dan the boy. He's the boy. Because Dan's father used to live there. So they're like, oh, you're with the godly boy. I'm like, what?
Danny.
Right. Now we would like to hear from Larry Roebling, who's Dan's producer now.
Okay. Well, this is the first I've heard of a condo in Margate. It has been such a joy to work on Voices almost for a year now, and Dan and I are going to continue to work together. You'll hear more about that later. But my favorite story about Dan actually happened while I was working at WHYY, and Dan was working with Mike and in the cubicle next to me. And as you all know, sometimes Dan has physical challenges, and he had had one of his bouts of an infection that he'd been battling, and he came back. Everyone was very excited to see him. He comes whipping around the corner. We're all glad to have him and say, like, Dan, how are you? He said, you know, the doctor told me I should go home and put my affairs in order. But I went home, I made my final arrangements, and then I bought a cemetery plot, and then I bought season tickets to the Phillies. And I go, okay. And he said, because I knew either way I'd have someplace to be over the summer.
We're sharing some good stories and laughs from 30 years of Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb. We're celebrating that anniversary, and this conversation was taped here at WHYY in front of a live audience. I'm Mike and Scott, and coming up, we'll be hearing from that audience. Many of them are fans of the show who have been listening for years. That's still to come here on WHYY.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at Karen.org. That's Caron.org.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at Devereaux.org.
This is a special edition of Voices in the Family, celebrating the show's 30th anniversary. I'm Mike and Scott, and Dan and I taped a conversation about the program's long history and its future here at WHYY with a big audience of about 150 people. Earlier on, Dan told us that he would retire from the weekly show after Thanksgiving, but he'll continue to do radio specials. During this portion of our conversation that we're about to hear, we were taking questions from the audience.
Hi, Dan. I feel that, perhaps I'm speaking for everybody in this room, every time I've heard you, I've grown as a person. I've had a richer life, a deeper life, a more compassionate life. I've learned to listen by listening to you listen and be patient with people. But what I'd like to do is sort of turn this back to you. How do you feel that your show has made you a better person?
Thank you, Rachel. That was Rachel Simon, who was recently on my show. We did a show on memoir. She wrote the bestseller, Riding the Bus, with my sister. The show has made me a better person. I think it's made me more loving, easier to love, allowed myself to be open to being loved. I mean, that's the word I keep coming back to. Love. It's this show, it's this audience, it's my life, it's what makes relationships real and whole.
Quick follow-up question. How do you listen? Is it something you do very intentionally? Obviously, it's what you do for work, whether it's here or in your office. And what could we learn about listening from how you do it?
I first have to listen to myself when I'm listening. So I have to be aware when my mind is racing or when I'm getting ready to say the next thing, because then you're not listening. If I'm having a difficult conversation, especially with somebody I love, I mean, I can feel my chest starting to tighten. And when that happens, I know I'm not listening. So in that moment, I'm able to let go and listen to the suffering of the other person across from me. That it's not about me. It's about the person that's talking. And you know, one of the things I taught my students in family therapy is you bring the family into the room, don't say a word, and the person that speaks first is the one that suffers most, is the one that needs to be heard most. Hear where they hurt. You know, and I approach a conversation like this like a good pediatrician. In my mind, I always have the question, where does it hurt? That makes it easier to listen.
Let's take another question.
I've appreciated and learned from you every time I've heard you. Now it's your turn to learn from me, because I retired many more years ago than I want to think. You will find in 6 months, you'll say to yourself, how did I ever have time to go to work?
Thank you. I'll call you in 6 months.
And let me tell you that Dan is a notorious overscheduler of himself. So hopefully the good people in his life will try to remind him, like, hey, Dan, you wanted to retire.
Let's take another question.
Thank you so much. First, Dr. Dan and Mike, and I want to just express deep, deep gratitude to you for just being who you are and for giving inspiration to all of us to look into the eyes of another human being and see another human being for who they are, without labels, without anything else. And that, to me, was just such an important contribution of what you have done and do every day in your show and in your life. My question is very related to that. So much of your work, you support people in conflict and deal with very, very intense conflict. From all your experience that you've had both in the show and as a therapist, are there things that you could share to best hold space for someone in conflict, for best to support someone who's going through very, very intense personal conflict? Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for what you said. I'm really touched by that. You know, if you were calling in the show, I'd ask you to be more specific and ask you if that question was personal, because that's so much easier than to generalize from that. But I think you answered your own question. Use the word space. There are very few emergencies in life. You know, you nick an artery, that's an emergency. But if there's intense conflict, take a breath. Give it space, give it room, and let's see what we have, really. It doesn't need to be resolved immediately, and nobody has to win immediately. There's a Zen story that I think I told in one of my books about a man who goes to his Zen master, and he tells his tale of woe and how everything is so bad for him. And the Zen master says, take a tablespoon of coarse salt and put it in a glass of water. And he dutifully does it. And he says, now drink it. And of course, it tastes awful. And he says, now take that same tablespoon of salt and put it in a clear brook. And now drink a glass of water. And the water was delicious. He said, the problem is not the salt. It's the container. Make the container bigger. Always make the container bigger. So you've answered your question.
Thank you for coining a term earlier that I just fell in love with, post-traumatic stress to post-traumatic growth. I love that. My question to you is, one of the things that I have always said about what peeves me when I meet somebody, and I will know instantaneously whether this person can be my friend or not, if this person does not listen to me as I listen to her or him, what do you do if you run across someone like that? How do you handle it? Besides running the other way.
It depends on the day. It depends on, you know, whether I'm 24 hours from being enlightened or 24 centuries. So if I'm 24 hours, hopefully I will feel for that person whose heart is closed, who can't sit still, who can't open up, who can't be present. I will feel for that person who struggles to be in their lives and instead spends most of their time in their head, lost in the stories they tell themselves about the truth of their lives, like so many of us.
Have you found working with people who are closed and into their own heads like that you've been able to make a difference?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one-on-one when they, you know, come to my office. But, you know, the question I ask anybody when they come to my office is, do you really want help? Do you really want to change? What are you willing to do to make change? And if the first answer is yes, I really want help, then people change. But if people are comfortable living their lives the way they do, you know, it's like the Pope said, who am I to judge? You know, if they're comfortable, even if they're suffering, but if they're comfortable living the lives they have, it's
it.
Different than me, but, you know, I work very hard to respect it, honor it, and feel compassion when I'm 24 hours.
Thank you.
When I'm 24 centuries, the hell with that.
I'm from the Council for Relationships, and I wanted to thank you for bringing the attention that you have to couples and family therapy. I wanted to ask you if there are any guests that you've had on the show that you really disagree with, and I'm hoping they're not from the Council for Relationships.
Sure, there have been many that I disagree. Many people who come in and oversimplify or too pop, who give answers that I think are dangerous. And sometimes I've been pretty aggressive at disagreeing with them.
Hi, Dan. In the interest of relationship, I'd like to say my name is Keith, and I'm wearing this hat, so if anyone wants to talk to me, I'm easy to recognize. And in the interest of self-revelation, I'm quite nervous. And I thought I was going to be emotional. I brought my own tissues, so, and I am. Right in the beginning, you described leaving an interview, I think you did, and someone acknowledging your talents, and then you said, and it felt wonderful, and it felt horrible. Are you willing to say something more about how it felt horrible?
Sure. It felt wonderful because I believed what she said, that I do have some talent doing this. It felt wonderful to have my talent acknowledged. It felt awful because at that moment I was struggling with giving up this show or the weekly show, and it felt awful because I was just feeling this pull back, and it's almost like I wanted the world to leave me alone so that I could struggle with this and on my own. Of course, the world never does. So within 90 seconds, she was giving me that compliment, and then we heard that this young employee's grandmother loves the show. Literally within 90 seconds. It was extraordinary.
Okay. I'd just like to give a quick tip on listening. It really helps if you hold somebody's hands, look in their eyes, and keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does. Sure does. And by the way, if you're a WHYY member, we'll give you the tissues. You don't have to.
Well, the last question, Dan. I've been listening to your show for about 10 years, and when I met you for the first time, I was terrified. And you said, don't worry. You know, we were sitting across the desk. You had your microphone in front of you. You were in your wheelchair. And you said, don't worry, I'm in control. And
I often tell that lie to guests to make them feel better.
And I actually believed it. And then over the years that I've known you, I learned what a big lie it was. But what I wanted to ask you to comment on, since I know you know how out of control we are of the universe around us, is how you relate to that day to day and how you'd advise us to relate to how out of control we are.
The illusion of control
that I talk about a lot. Rob,
hold on, let's introduce who
we're
speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Rob Nassif is a dear, dear friend of mine, a colleague, and a really gifted psychotherapist who specializes in working with families where there's autism.
And that's partially true.
How do I relate to being out of control? It varies. I mean, it varies depending on the day. You know, often able to help people rest, you know, kind of float in their lives, knowing that floating is kind of an act of faith. And when you do let go and float, you feel more secure, you can feel held by the universe. Not that it's safe out there, not that you won't get hurt, not that you won't die at the end. But, you know, it's about the process and acknowledging our own vulnerability, acknowledging our own fears, sharing that with others, being embraced by others and holding them in theirs. I was at Jefferson Hospital years ago, waiting in the lobby to be picked up. And there was a woman coming out with her five-year-old boy, about four or five years old. They were holding hands. And she was wearing a turban and looked pretty emaciated from chemotherapy. And they were facing this big revolving door, you know, these giant revolving doors. And the boy's holding his mother's hand, and he says, "Mommy, I'm scared," referring to the door. And she says, "You know, honey, I'm a little scared too, but we'll hold hands and we'll go through it together." And that's how we deal with our vulnerability. We hold hands and we go through it together, which is what I've been doing with this audience for 30 years.
An emotional and powerful end to this conversation with Dan Gottlieb, taped here at WHYY before a live audience. Dan did announce that he will retire after Thanksgiving, but he will continue to host live events and do radio specials for WHYY. And again, until Thanksgiving, we'll be having a regular Voices in the Family show every Monday. Next week's show is an open show about when is it time. He'll be talking with psychologist Barbara Wingate, and of course, he'll be taking your phone calls. You can follow us on Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and you can email us at voices@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineers for this live event were Al Banks and Bob Alls. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family. Dan Gottlieb will be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.